was inspired to spend a few minutes talking about loving kindness today, metta. Partly the inspiration came from Valentine's Day. My son went through his first Valentine's Day event at daycare. And it's changed, apparently, since I was a kid. My earliest memories of Valentine's Day, it was not an institutionalized event. It was an event which, as a second or third grader, I tried to avoid like the plague. And it was, you know, all kind of the kids kind of organized and did things. And, you know, it was like some people, you know, you wouldn't want to get that card from that girl or something, you know. So it was kind of a complicated event. And as a boy, I remember not being particularly pleased by it. But the way it worked in daycare was that my son had to go come prepared with a Valentine's Day card for everyone in the class. Not just simply all the girls in the class, but everyone in the class had to get one from him. And he got one from everybody else. So I thought that, you know, it was a very lovely kind of Buddhist way of doing things. Because in Buddhism, the idea of loving kindness is you start with someone who's really dear to you. You start with your natural feelings or whatever, your common tendencies for feeling love and delight in someone. And then you appreciate that, and then you universalize it. You don't stick to it, to your own self-interest, but rather you start from there and you kind of begin dissolving the boundaries that keep you from having those feelings towards other people. And so they become, it becomes universalized. The universalization of loving kindness is a very important part of Buddhist practice. And there are specific practices that people do to what's called breaking down the barriers or breaking down the boundaries, so the experience of our goodwill becomes universal. So it goes, you know, spreads beyond our toes and our ears to other places also, other people. The practice of loving kindness, or the sentiment of loving kindness, the intention of loving kindness, is simply the wish and desire for someone's well-being. And it's that simple, someone's well-being for their happiness. And that someone can also be oneself. And usually in Buddhism, we start with ourselves. Can you hear okay? Is it difficult? Or should we? I hear you. You okay with hearing? Or? And so this, usually we start with ourselves. We kind of want our own well-being. But here in the West, it seems that certain individuals, certain people, a large proportion of people, have a hard time starting with themselves. So because we're, you know, obviously demons and monsters and whatever. So we start with someone else that we can, a friend or a partner or a family member or a benefactor or someone, a child or maybe, and then from that, from doing it to someone else, then maybe it's easier to kind of then ease into doing it oneself. Everyone deserves one's own well-being, a desire for one's own well-being, a loving kindness. So it's sometimes a little tricky to find that. But it's a very simple, simply the desire for someone's well-being. And what it's supposed to be absent of is self-interest. Now, that's maybe easy to understand in relationship to other people. Can you have some kind of feeling of kindness, some kind of feeling of desiring the welfare of someone else without wanting something in exchange and in return? You see someone who is in trouble on the street and you stop and help them and you finish with helping them and you go on your way and you don't think about it anymore. You don't want anything in return. You simply wanted to help them. I stopped someone the other day and their car was stuck in the intersection and she was trying to push it. So I got out of my car, parked it, and pushed her car out of the intersection and then it drove her to some gas station where she wanted to go, but I drove her someplace. And then I left and I didn't want anything in return. I just wanted to help her out a little bit at the moment. So to have some kind of feeling of loving kindness, I guess the stress on the word loving kindness is on the kindness. that is absent of self-interest. And this, for some people, is a very foreign idea, and maybe a challenging idea. And the more challenging idea it is, I think the more valuable it is for us to explore it. Not that you have to believe it or adopt it as a policy, but rather to clarify what is your way, what is the way in which you relate to other people? What is the way you choose to relate to them? Is it usually with some element of self-interest as part of it? And is it interesting to, maybe as an act of imagination, to explore being involved with someone else's happiness and well-being without any self-interest as part of it? And what does it mean to have no self-interest in wanting your own well-being? I think that's much more challenging because, you know, it's for me after all. But I think there's a way in which you can want your own well-being, your own happiness, without being related to the kind of self-interest that involves building up our ego or building up our identity or doing it because we want to appear a certain way for other people, doing it because we're attached to being to experiences of pleasure. Happiness and pleasure are very different animals. And some people are confused about the two. So can we want our own happiness without self-interest being embedded as a part of it? It's a beautiful thing, the desire for one's own well-being. It can be very simple, the benefits of it. Today I was a little bit late coming down here, getting in my car to come down here. There were various things happened. The phone repairman came on a Sunday morning, and he needed me to do something in the house. And my son needed something. So I was running a little bit late, so I started getting a little bit hurried. And I kind of hurried into the car and just kind of... And then there was problems with the car. So, you know, I was a little bit delayed. And so by the time I got on the road, I was a little bit in a hurry or harried. And then as soon as I drove out the driveway, I remembered, I want to talk about loving kindness today. But, well, this is a good time for it. And so I thought, it would be nice to be well right now and not be in a hurry. And simply wanting that, simply having that desire, being reminded of that as a possibility, dissipated my harriedness very quickly. It would have been very easy to have continued with my preoccupation of getting down here and talking about loving kindness and how important it is to talk about it. But luckily the topic itself was kind of self-correcting. And in that particular instant, it was very easy to kind of change my mood. So I wanted to tell you the story, one version of the story, of when the Buddha first taught the practice of loving kindness. This version comes from about 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. I don't know the genealogy of this story, but the story itself claims that it was passed down orally from the time of the Buddha. There was a large group of monastics, monks and nuns, who were going to go and spend 4 months doing the rains retreat. The tradition in India was, in the monastic orders, to spend 3 or 4 months on retreat every year. We had to stay in one place and just practice in one place for that period of time, not wander around India. And as was the custom at that time, before the monks would go off on their own, someplace in the jungles and the mountains or wherever off in India, they'd go find the Buddha and get some kind of instructions for the retreat, what kind of meditation practice to do while they're on the retreats. So they went to the Buddha, these 500 monastics went to the Buddha and said, what should we do? And the Buddha gave him some really wonderful practice. Now, some recorded what, but he gave him wonderful practice. And so they were very delighted, and they went off to northern India, up into the foothills of the Himalayas, where there was some beautiful forest, and they found this beautiful lake that was, beautiful kind of quartz-colored lake, really beautiful and clear and pristine water. And there were these huge, huge trees, banyan trees perhaps. They were just being wonderful shade and wonderful kind of enclosures around these big roots of the banyan trees where people can sit and meditate. And temperature was really beautiful. Maybe it was up near Kashmir, you know, where people would go off and to get away from the heat. And it just seemed everything, and there was little villages nearby, and there was a nice little market town nearby where they can go on alms rounds, because they depended on every day to get their food. They needed to go on alms round to get their food from the villagers. So it seemed like these beautiful conditions. So they sat down and started meditating, and the villagers noticed they were there within hours, and the villagers were delighted. They didn't get to see Buddhist monastics very often. So they went, "Oh, you know, we're so happy you're here for the rains retreat. We're going to build you little huts." So they built little huts under each tree. So there are 500 huts under 500 of these big, beautiful trees spread out in this huge forested area. And it was very idyllic, and the monks or monastics were very happy to be there. Now, under these big, majestic banyan trees, the big, majestic banyan trees, they happen to be very ideal foundations, foundation poles, for the mansions of certain deities. And these deities had built mansions, huge mansions, you know, up on the canopy, building up into the sky. No one could see them, of course, but they were there. And now, at first, these deities were quite delighted to have all these Buddhist monastics appear under their houses. They had a lot of respect for the work of liberation that the monastics were doing. And out of respect, they retreated from the houses, because it's very disrespectful in Indian culture to be on a higher level than someone doing something very worthy, like seeking liberation. So, and certainly don't want to be directly on top of their head. That's a real no-no in Indian culture. So they would retreat. They kind of went to the side. Now, for our first couple of days, they were happy to do this. But this was, these were their homes they were leaving. So after 3 or 4 days, they started getting kind of, you know, restless and homesick, and, you know. And after a few more days, they started feeling, well, this is not working, you know. We need to get back to our family, our kids, you know, everything's there back in our homes, our televisions, and you know, and we need our entertainment, and we need to kind of get our food and whatever we need. So they started getting a little bit distressed. They decided to try to gently first to frighten away the monastics. And then they kind of started getting more and more adamant about it, and they started making harrowing sounds and thunder and had great, you know, they did all kinds of things, had great images of great demons and dragons that came and billowed fire, and it got really noisy and terrifying noises, and the monastics got so terrified and so preoccupied with all this stuff that deities were doing, they lost their mindfulness. Imagine. So that was enough for them. They said, well, you know, it was okay while we still had our mindfulness, but now we don't have our mindfulness anymore. So they said, let's go back to the Buddha and tell him. So they went back to the Buddha and told them what had happened. And the Buddha then used his psychic powers and scanned across India. And he decided that, or he saw, that there was no better place for those 500 monastics to get liberated than that particular forest by that particular lake. So he said, you've got to go back. And he said, no way, we can't go back. It's frightening there. So the Buddha said, okay, I'll teach you a practice. And I'll teach you about loving kindness. So he taught them about the practice of loving kindness, and he gave them a discourse or a poem or a verses called the Loving Kindness Sutra discourse that they memorized. And he taught them the practice of loving kindness, of goodwill, and he sent them back. And as they were coming up the road, returning to that forest, they were chanting the chant of loving kindness. May all beings be well, may all beings be happy. Just like a mother protects her only child, so may you treat all beings, wishing them well-being and happiness. And so they were reciting these verses, and they were practicing goodwill, wishing goodwill to, spreading universal goodwill to all beings everywhere as they were walking. Now, as they started approaching this jungle, the deities were up in their mansions in the treetops, started feeling really warm and kind of, warm-hearted. and feeling kind of delighted, and said, "Oh, so something really great's happening here." So they looked around. They saw, "Oh, the monastics are returning," and they felt these radiant waves of goodwill and loving kindness coming from these monastics. They said, "Oh, you know, let's change our tune here. I think we want them here. It's so nice to have this feeling of goodwill. Let's not frighten them this time. Let's get down from our mansions and let's transform ourselves into human beings for the next three months. And let's be the attendants to these monastics, and let's clean their cabins, their huts, and let's bring them water and bring them food and just optimize the conditions for them so they can have the facilities and the place and locations and everything to get liberated during these 3 months." And so these monks and nuns then practiced diligently and peacefully for those 3 months. And by the end of the 3 months, each of those 500 monastics had attained full liberation. Isn't that a nice story? It's a great story. You can you know, interpret the story in many ways, understand it in many ways, but it's one way it's kind of a dramatic way of saying that the expression of goodwill, the feeling of goodwill, wanting other people's well-being, generates a certain response in the world around you. It's not clear always what kind of response, and it's not always clear, but the response tends to be a response of goodwill in return, of kindness in return, of generosity in return. And you might try it sometimes in a situation where you find yourself in hostility or animosity in an intense situation with someone, where your normal reaction might be to get kind of huffy or get kind of tight and kind of get angry. See if you can find some genuine desire inside of you for some alternative way of being. And then see if it can be very kind of smudging little bit of, you know, alternative that you feel in there because the animosity is so strong. But see if you can find some genuine root inside of you wanting someone's well-being, or at least your own well-being. And then see if you can have some feeling of kindness or friendliness to the situation, to the person that you're relating to. And then see what happens. See if that elicits a different response than you would otherwise have had. Like my friend who I forget exactly the story, but he was in a parking lot and he wasn't getting out of the way fast enough, or his car stalled or something. And so someone who was really in a hurry and really angry started yelling at him and cussing at him and said, how could you do this to me on a Sunday morning? And my friend, you know, didn't take it on, the hostility, and didn't return it, but rather was mostly concerned about this guy's welfare, you know, felt a little bit bad about blocking his car or whatever, but he had no choice. And he, at some point, he said to him in a very kind way, in a way that apparently worked, he said, "Oh, you're having a really hard morning, aren't you?" And that just melted the hostility. "Oh yeah, it's really been rough today." And then, you know, the situation unfolded just fine. Another story, if you let me tell you stories today, shorter story. The Buddha had a cousin named Devadatta. And Devadatta was very jealous of the Buddha. He wanted to have the Buddha's place. He wanted to kind of be the Buddha, you know, run the show, run the order of monks and nuns, and be the top dog, or top gun, or whatever it's called. And so he was trying to find various ways to get the Buddha out of the scene, get rid of him. And various times try to kill the Buddha. And one of his attempts to kill the Buddha was he got the huge royal tusker, this big elephant, had big tusks, and it was a big kind of warrior that was used in battle. So it had a certain ability to be aggressive. And he got this great royal tusker of an elephant really angry. And just kind of inside its pen. When the Buddha started walking down the road towards where the elephant was penned up, Devadatta had the gate opened up. And the tusker saw the Buddha first and Okay, came storming out down the road. And full charge, ready to gore the Buddha. And Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant, was rushed up in front of the Buddha to stand in the way to kind of somehow stop or somehow protect the Buddha. And the Buddha calmly said, "No, Ananda, you're not needed right now. Please stand aside." Well, so he's an obedient attendant, so he stepped aside. And the Buddha then started to generate loving kindness, generate feelings of goodwill towards the elephant. And as the elephant came charging forward, it started slowing down, slowing down, slowing down. By the time it reached the Buddha, the elephant was on its knees, kind of smiling nicely in the Buddha. And again, you know, you shouldn't try this with elephants. I think it's Sharon Salzberg who tried it with the dog. Is that the story? Someone know the story? Yeah. Tried it with the dog at Barry, and the dog bit her. So you know, maybe you should take this as being, you know, a little bit of a mythic story, but there's a principle behind it that's useful. That the desire for to generate kindness, to be kind, and to generate in a sincere way, to see it as a valid and valuable and sincere alternative to acting on our hostility or acting on our animosity or on our greed, changes things. It changes us, ourselves, but it also changes the environment and changes other people, and they respond to us in different ways because of it. And life unfolds a lot more beautifully when we have... when we can tap into that capacity of kindness and loving kindness within ourselves. So we have in Buddhism an emphasis on reflecting and contemplating, thinking about, studying the psychology and the practices of loving kindness. Even if you don't believe in any of this, to spend some time, you know, thinking about it, reflecting on it. And then to engage yourself in contemplative practices of loving kindness. A little bit of it like what we did at the beginning, at the end of the sitting just now. But to find ways of finding one's intention, however minuscule it might be, of goodwill towards oneself or goodwill towards others. And then feeding that goodwill, in a sense, by expressing it, giving expression to it. Giving expression to our wholesome states of mind feeds them and they grow. And they become a more familiar part of who we are. They become more readily available to us so that they're at hand when we most need them. So, may you all leave today at least challenge to contemplate the practice of loving, the sentiment of loving kindness, the wish of loving kindness, of goodwill. And if it all seems interesting for you, spend some time practicing with it. And that's what we have to say today. May you all be well, may you all be happy, and may you all stay dry enough. Thank you.